John Hinckley sees Ronald Reagan clearly. He also sees the small crowd of agents, body men in Secret Service parlance, accompanying the president. Hinckley notices James Brady moving toward the rope line. Things are happening very quickly. The president raises his right arm and waves to the crowd. A woman calls out from the spectator area as if she knows him. A friendly Reagan motions in her direction. Normally, the president wears a bulletproof vest when appearing in public, but the walk from the door to the car is so short that the Secret Service did not think he needed it today. John Hinckley braces his right arm against the rough stone wall, dropping his hand into his pocket. Quickly, he pulls the gun out. Later, Hinckley testifies that his head tells him, "Put the gun away." But he does not. Tomorrow, the worldwide media will take one look at this loner and describe him as a deranged gunman, as if he has no idea what he is doing. But John Warnock Hinckley is a cold-blooded killer, a man who has trained himself in the art of murder. Just as he has done so many times at the firing range, Hinckley grasps the butt of the pistol with two hands for maximum stability. He bends his knees and drops into a shooter's crouch, then extends both arms and pulls the trigger. The first bullet hits James Brady square in the head, just above the left eye. He falls face first to the sidewalk, his blood dripping through a sidewalk grate. The second shot strikes Washington Metro Police Officer Thomas K. Delahanty in the neck, ricocheting off his spine and lodging against the spinal column. He falls to the ground in agony, screaming. The third shot goes wild, hitting no one. The fourth shot strikes Secret Service agent Tim McCarthy in the torso. He, too, falls to the sidewalk, seriously wounded, a bullet lodged in his liver. The fifth shot bounces off the limousine. The sixth also hits the Lincoln, but ricochets, piercing Ronald Reagan's body under his left arm. The bullet enters his lung, coming to rest just 1 inch from his heart. The President of the United States staggers. It takes just 1.7 seconds for Hinckley to fire all six devastators. The assassin is immediately punched in the head by a nearby spectator, then gang-tackled by the crowd. Hinckley is buried beneath several hundred pounds of angry citizens as Secret Service agents try to take him alive. Ironically, their job is now to protect Hinckley with the same vigor they devote to protecting the president. As Hinckley is subdued, three men are fighting for their lives. One of them is Ronald Wilson Reagan. At the sound of the first bullet, Agent Jerry Parr grabs Reagan by the waist, shoving him hard into the back of the limo. The two men land in a heap with Parr on top. As Reagan's face hits the armrest dividing the back seat, an intense wave of pain shoots through his body. "Jerry!" he cries. "Get off! I think you broke one of my ribs!" The president is angry, believing Parr was unnecessarily rough. Parr is not interested in delicacy. He needs to get the president to safety immediately. Long ago, as a boy, it was the 1939 Ronald Reagan movie Code of the Secret Service that inspired Parr to become an agent. Now, through a brutal coincidence, Jerry Parr has become the most important person in Reagan's life. "White House!" he barks at Agent Drew Unruh, who sits at the wheel. "Let's get out of here! Haul ass!" Parr climbs off the president. Neither man knows that Ronald Reagan has been shot, but as Reagan tries to sit up, he is almost paralyzed by pain. He coughs hard, sending a stream of bright red blood onto his hand. "You not only broke a rib," he tells Parr as the presidential limousine races to the safety of the White House. "I think the rib punctured my lung." "Were you hit?" asks a concerned Parr. "No, I don't think so." Parr runs his hands over the president's shoulders, chest, and head. He sees no sign of blood. Reagan can barely sit up, his face ashen. He begins pressing his left arm against his chest as if having a heart attack. Reagan tastes blood and tells Parr that he might have also cut his mouth. The agent looks closely, seeing that the bright red blood on Reagan's lips contains numerous air bubbles, which is the sign of a lung injury. "I think we should go to the hospital," Parr tells Reagan. "Okay," Reagan answers, still believing that Parr broke his rib. At the same time, in the third-floor White House solarium, Secret Service Agent Opfer calmly enters the room and interrupts Nancy Reagan's conversation with the White House's chief usher. "There was a shooting," Opfer informs the First Lady. "The President is going to the hospital." Immediately distraught, Nancy Reagan is led out of the White House. Her Secret Service code name is Rainbow, in reference to the many colors of her fiery personality, but there is no evidence of that on display right now. She is quiet and terrified. A car is brought around, and Nancy's frustration intensifies as the two-limousine motorcade gets caught in Washington gridlock on its 10-block journey. "I'm going to get out and walk," she yells. "I need to walk. I have to get there." Traffic begins to flow, and 15 minutes after leaving the White House, Nancy Reagan's limousine pulls up to the George Washington University Hospital. As soon as the vehicle stops at the emergency entrance of the gray cinder block building, she sprints toward the emergency room. Waiting at the door is Deputy Chief of Staff Mike Deaver. "He's been hit," Deaver tells her. "But they told me he wasn't hit," replies a shocked Nancy Reagan. "I want to see my husband," she pleads. It takes Ronald Reagan's limousine 4 minutes to get to the hospital. He walks through the front door under his own power, then passes out and collapses hard to the floor. He is immediately transported to the emergency room. "I feel so bad," Ronald Reagan tells the paramedic, who quickly begins cutting the clothes off the president's body. "I feel really awful. I can't breathe." This is the first indication that something is very wrong with Ronald Reagan. At first, doctors believe Reagan may die. Now, an attempt to take his blood pressure has not yielded a systolic reading, meaning that his heart is barely pumping. All around Reagan, the emergency room is a frantic scene of doctors, nurses, and well-armed Secret Service agents. Dr. Joseph Giordano, a surgeon who heads the hospital's trauma team, is inserting a clear plastic chest tube into Reagan, hoping to drain the blood from his chest cavity. "This better go well," Giordano tells himself as he slices open the president's skin. "He was seriously injured," Giordano will later remember. "He was close to dying." Ronald Reagan is a 70-year-old man who has just suffered a devastating trauma. Not only was he shot, but he was thrown bodily into a car and his head slammed hard into an armrest. His body may not have the ability to endure much more. Reagan is conscious throughout the trauma procedure. Once he is stabilized, the next step will be surgery to remove the bullet. Spotting Jerry Parr just before being wheeled to the operating room, Reagan shows the first signs that he might make it. "I hope they're all Republicans," he tells the Secret Service agent who saved his life less than 30 minutes ago. "Mr. President," Dr. Giordano, a lifelong Democrat, tells Reagan, "today we are all Republicans." A pained but lucid Ronald Reagan is being prepped for surgery. Lying on the gurney, he looks up to find Nancy Reagan gazing down at him. She is unsteady. Blood loss has made her husband's skin the palest white she has ever seen. A nurse removes the president's oxygen mask from his mouth. "Honey," he tells her, hoping that a joke will erase the fear from her face. "I forgot to duck." Nancy fights tears as she bends down to kiss him. "Please don't try to talk," she whispers. Later, Nancy will remember this moment with sadness and fear. "I saw him lying naked, with strangers looking down at his naked body and watching the life ebb from him, and as a doctor's daughter, I knew that he was dying," she will recount to her friends. But Ronald Reagan is experiencing another reaction. He will later write of the joy this moment gives him. "Seeing Nancy in the hospital gave me an enormous lift. As long as I live, I will never forget the thought that rushed into my head as I looked up into her face. Later, I wrote it down in my diary. I pray I'll never face a day when she isn't here. Of all the ways God had blessed me, giving her to me was the greatest, beyond anything I can ever hope to deserve. Reagan is wheeled into surgery. Nancy clings to the bed's handrail the whole while, walking with the team of doctors and the now surgically gowned Secret Service agents who will accompany her husband into Operating Room 2. "Who's minding the store?" Reagan asks Ed Meese as the gurney passes the White House counselor. At the double doors leading into the surgery center, Nancy is told she cannot accompany her husband any farther. The time is 3:24 p.m. All she can do is wait. At 4 p.m., Ronald Reagan lies unconscious on the operating table. A rib spreader pulls his fifth and sixth ribs apart, allowing Dr. Ben Aaron to see clearly inside Reagan's chest. The seventh rib is indeed fractured, thanks to the bullet glancing off it. More troublesome is the blood filling the chest cavity. The president has lost half his total blood supply. Tubes running into Reagan's body fill him with new blood, antibiotics, and hydration fluid. Dr. Aaron's goal is to remove the bullet from Reagan's body, but there is a big problem. While he can trace its path through the half-inch-wide hole it has left in the tissue and lung, he cannot find the location of the .22-caliber round. Using his fingers, Aaron reaches inside the president's body and feels for the bullet, delicately working around Reagan's slowly beating heart as he does so. "I might call it quits," the surgeon says, frustrated he can find no sign of the bullet. Frustration also reigns 1 mile away at the White House. "Who is running the government in the absence of President Reagan?" a journalist asks Deputy Press Secretary Larry Speaks on live television. All across America, millions are glued to their TV sets as regular programming has been interrupted. A somber America awaits news about the severely wounded Ronald Reagan. But if viewers are looking for reassurance, Speaks' words do not provide it. "I cannot answer that question at this time," he responds. One floor below where the press conference is taking place, members of Ronald Reagan's cabinet huddle in the White House Situation Room, horrified at Speaks' response. Even worse, they know something that the press secretary does not. The Soviets are taking advantage of Reagan's condition by moving their submarines alarmingly close to America's east coast. A nuclear missile could strike Washington in just 11 minutes. Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger has ordered America's bomber crews to go on high standby alert. Yet, with the president now unconscious and Vice President George H.W. Bush in the air somewhere over Texas, no one at the White House has the direct authority to respond to the Soviet threat. Vice President George H.W. Bush was slated to give a speech in Austin, Texas. When news came that Reagan had been shot, he returned to Washington. Fearing the worst, National Security Advisor Richard Allen has ordered that the special briefcase known as the Football, which contains the nuclear launch codes that could begin World War III, be brought to him. It now sits on a conference table here in the Situation Room, safely concealed beneath a small pile of papers. Suddenly, General Alexander Haig takes charge. The Secretary of State, who has long sought to expand his power, appoints himself temporary president. "The helm is right here," he declares to the startled cabinet members, "and that means in this chair right now, constitutionally, until the vice president gets here." Haig, an intimidating man, looks around, daring anyone to dispute him. Constitutionally, the general is incorrect. Speaker of the House Tip O'Neill should be next in line, but no one in the Situation Room cares to defy the former four-star Army general who fought in Vietnam and Korea. "How do you get to the press room?" he asks, rising from his chair. The room goes silent. Before anyone can stop him, Haig races upstairs and barges into the press center. Knees buckling, voice cracking, and hands grasping the lectern so hard his knuckles turn white, Alexander Haig proclaims his authority to the nation on live TV. "As of now, I am in control here in the White House. Nancy Reagan is not in control. She is desperately praying. She sits in the hospital chapel along with the wives of Press Secretary James Brady and Secret Service Agent Tim McCarthy. All three of their husbands are currently in surgery. The women are unaware that the media will soon report that James Brady is dead. The women are not alone in this small second-floor sanctuary. White House Chief of Staff James Baker kneels in prayer, while Mike Deaver and Ed Meese join the vigil. They are as close to the president as any group of advisors could be, and the wait is torturous. Finally, at 5:25 p.m., thanks to a set of X-rays that show the bullet's location, Dr. Aaron feels the dime-sized chunk of metal. The surgeon plucks the bullet from Reagan's lung with his fingertips. "I've got it," he tells the surgical team, which includes a member of the Secret Service, who now steps forward to retrieve the bullet as evidence. Dr. Aaron now turns his attention to the non-stop internal bleeding that still might kill Ronald Reagan. Finally, at 6:46 p.m., an unconscious Reagan is closed up and wheeled from the operating room. The greatest crisis has passed, but danger remains. Within an hour, Reagan is awake, though groggy. A breathing tube in his throat makes it impossible for him to talk, so he scribbles a note to his nurse. "If I'd had this much attention in Hollywood, I'd have stayed there." 20 miles away at Andrews Air Force Base, the plane carrying Vice President George H.W. Bush has finally touched down on the runway. His return marks the end of Alexander Haig's self-declared 3-hour reign as leader of the free world. And while Haig was legally wrong to declare himself in charge, his blunt behavior has had one positive effect. Soviet forces are backing down. Haig never recovered from the public perception that he had become unglued in this time of crisis. He was fired as Secretary of State 15 months later and ran unsuccessfully for president in 1988. In the White House Situation Room, National Security Advisor Richard Allen breathes a sigh of relief that there will be no need to open the special briefcase containing the nuclear launch codes. Not today, at least. Meanwhile, John Hinckley sits in a Washington, D.C. interrogation room. He complains that his wrist might be broken. There are also cuts and bruises on his face from being shoved to the concrete sidewalk. But for the most part, Hinckley is calm as Detective Eddie Myers of the Washington Metro Police Department's Homicide Division interrogates him. "How do you spell assassinate?" Myers absent-mindedly asks a fellow officer during the questioning. "Assassinate," Hinckley answers, grinning. The FBI has requested Hinckley be given a physical, including retrieving a sample of his pubic hair. "Pubic hair?" the grizzled Myers asks in disbelief. "For Christ's sakes, he didn't fuck Reagan, he shot him." It is not until morning that Ronald and Nancy Reagan are allowed to see each other again. She has spent a long night alone in the White House, sleeping at the side of his bed, hugging one of her husband's T-shirts to feel his presence. At 10 a.m., Nancy enters the intensive care unit with Patty and Ron Reagan, who have made the flight to Washington upon hearing of the shooting. Although Michael and Maureen Reagan have traveled to the hospital, they are not ushered in until Nancy's children have had their moment. Ronald Reagan is oblivious to any sibling rivalry. He sees his family and is deeply moved. His breathing tube has been taken out, allowing him to joke and visit with Nancy and his children. He knows the shooting has changed his life forever. "Whatever happens now, I owe my life to God," he will write in his diary, "and I will try to serve him in every way I can." 20. House of Representatives, Washington, D.C., April 28, 1981, 7 p.m. The president who was nearly killed is bathed in applause. Members of Congress leap to their feet in bipartisan support of the man who was hit by an assassin's bullet a little more than 4 weeks ago. Ronald Reagan is visibly thinner and frail, but is walking easily under his own power. The roar continues as Reagan strolls to the podium and shakes hands with Vice President George Bush, who also serves as President of the Senate. Reagan greets the rotund, white-haired Speaker of the House, Massachusetts Congressman Tip O'Neill. The President then turns to address the Congress. But the ovation will not end. Reagan grins. He is genuinely thrilled by the outpouring of warmth. His cheeks and forehead are red thanks to hours spent enjoying the sun in the White House solarium during his recovery. He wears a well-tailored dark blue suit with a gray and blue striped tie. Referring to the shooting, Reagan launches an unexpected joke. "You wouldn't want to talk me into an encore." Laughter erupts. After 3 full minutes, the applause finally dies down and Reagan begins his remarks. The purpose of the speech is to gain congressional approval for his economic recovery program. However, almost immediately he detours from the details of that plan to speak from the heart. "Mr. Speaker," Reagan begins, "distinguished members of the Congress, honored guests and fellow citizens, I have no words to express my appreciation for that greeting. I'd like to say a few words directly to all of you and to those who are watching and listening tonight, because this is the only way I know to express to all of you, on behalf of Nancy and myself, our appreciation for your messages and flowers, and most of all, your prayers, not only for me, but for those others who fell beside me." At the mention of her name, all eyes shift to Nancy Reagan. She sits in the front row of the congressional balcony wearing a bright red dress. The murder attempt has rattled her so deeply that she has stricken the word assassination from her vocabulary. Her public approval rating is one of the worst a first lady has ever experienced, for many consider her a controlling ice queen. But what the public does not know is that Nancy Reagan sobbed at the hospital after her husband was shot. Even now, there are moments when she completely breaks down emotionally. Nancy knows the little things about her husband that every wife knows, that Ronald Reagan likes his eggs soft-boiled for precisely 4 minutes, that his favorite soup is a hearty combination of beef broth and lean ground hamburger served with a slice of French bread, and that the bumps on his left hand are caused by a hereditary disease that forces his pinky finger to curl permanently into his palm. Nancy Reagan is one of the few who saw how pale and feeble her husband was in the hours after the shooting. For the first time, with those great dark circles under his eyes and haggard wrinkles, he looked like an old man. She saw the same frailty when he returned to the White House, walking in small, hesitant steps, his arms punctured by intravenous injections. In those days, he slept on a hospital bed in the Lincoln bedroom, reliant on pain pills to get through the day and night. Nancy has even given up her own nightly sleeping pill to make sure that she will hear her husband should he cry out. The First Lady's obsession with her husband's well-being extends to the public arena. Nancy Reagan now works with Deputy Chief of Staff Michael Deaver to regulate the president's schedule. Fearing that he will be overscheduled, Nancy decides whom Reagan will and will not see. This practice will continue throughout Reagan's presidency. Nancy's behavior is so hands-on that Deaver will one day state, "I always imagined that when I died there would be a phone in my coffin, and at the other end of it would be Nancy Reagan." She also watched with trepidation on April 16th as Ronald Reagan made his first public appearance since the shooting, taking a stroll around the Rose Garden before photographers. The nation marveled at his vigor and quick recovery, but Nancy knows it was all a carefully orchestrated facade, designed to reassure Americans that their 70-year-old president was still very capable of leading the country. On this evening, Nancy supervises her husband's meticulous pre-speech preparation. It begins with Ronald Reagan styling his hair immediately after stepping out of the shower. Reagan combs his still-wet locks forward until they hang over his eyes in long bangs. Then he applies a dab of Brill Cream in order to hold his hair in place and maintain the wet look. Only then does the president sweep his hair back, deftly combing it into the trademark pompadour that takes years off his appearance. "I never realized how much your face has changed when you comb your hair up in that pompadour," Michael Deaver once said to Reagan after witnessing the hairstyling ritual. At first, with the hair hanging down on Reagan's face, Deaver was concerned that Reagan looked 80 years old. But with each stroke of the comb, youth magically reappears. "Oh, yes," the president told Deaver. "It takes all the lines right out of my face." Nancy has seen the combing ritual many times, just as she has seen countless makeup artists try to coax her husband into their chair before a big television appearance or a speech under bright lights. But hearkening back to his old Hollywood days, Ronald Reagan refuses to wear makeup. That red-rouged appearance he now displays on the congressional podium is all natural. These are the peculiarities of a man who has long charted his own course, and after his near-death experience, Nancy is thankful for the gift of being able to witness them at all. Not that the shooting is entirely behind the first couple. Nancy alone knows that even now, basking in the relieved applause of his political friends and rivals, Ronald Reagan is summoning all his strength and concealing a great deal of pain in order to give this address. Nancy needs strength as well. She knows America does not like her. The press has been ruthless, disapproving of what they perceive to be her power over the president. The criticism nettles her, but Nancy endures it. She can be a vain, selfish, and even deluded woman, far too reliant on fortune-tellers. But she is also very clever, and her loyalty and love for Ronald Reagan are absolute. The president feels Nancy's approval as his speech transitions from the personal to the patriotic. "The warmth of your words, the expression of friendship, and yes, love, meant more to us than you can ever know," Reagan tells America and the Congress. "You have given us a memory that we'll treasure forever. And you've provided an answer to those few voices that were raised saying that what happened was evidence that ours is a sick society." Reagan pauses for dramatic emphasis. "Well, sick societies don't produce men like the two who recently returned from outer space." The president is referring to astronauts John Young and Robert Crippen, who successfully piloted a new craft known as the Space Shuttle on its inaugural voyage into the heavens during Reagan's convalescence. Columbia's journey forever changes manned spaceflight. What Crippen and Young accomplished is indeed revolutionary. It seems that the entire world has undergone a major transition in the 29 days since John Hinckley opened fire. The days of Reagan's recovery also marked the end of an era, when the last top American World War II general, Omar N. Bradley, died at the age of 88. Just one day later, on April 9th, a frightening new epoch begins when the first confirmed diagnosis of a disease that will come to be known as AIDS takes place in San Francisco. And just 4 days previously, Reagan penned his long-delayed letter to Soviet Premier Leonid Brezhnev, opening a new epoch of relations between the two nuclear superpowers. Reagan expressed a willingness to sit down at the negotiating table with Brezhnev, as the Soviet Premier had demanded. However, Reagan also made it clear that a great deal of tension in the world today is due to Soviet actions. He took Brezhnev to task for the Soviet nuclear and military buildup and for its ongoing attempts to use force directly and indirectly to increase its sphere of influence. But the greatest changes to Reagan since the assassination attempt are more personal. In addition to allowing Nancy to assume control of his schedule, he surprised her one recent Sunday morning by suggesting they go to church. In the past, religion has been mostly politically expedient to the president. After the shooting, however, Ronald Reagan has become a man who understands his own mortality and is determined to draw closer to God. "Sick societies," Reagan continues, "don't produce young men like Secret Service agent Tim McCarthy, who placed his body between mine and the man with the gun simply because he felt that's what his duty called for him to do." Agent McCarthy, the recipient of John Hinckley's fourth bullet, checked out of George Washington University Hospital on April 7th. He will spend the rest of his life joking that the Devastator round ruined his new woolen suit. More important, the Secret Service will soon begin showing new agents videotape of the Reagan assassination attempt, pointing to the way McCarthy shifted his body into a linebacker crouch, with arms up and legs slightly wider than shoulder width, to protect the president. In doing so, Tim McCarthy exposed himself to the bullet. The round spun McCarthy as it entered the right side of his abdomen, knocking him to the ground. In a split second, the .22 caliber slug hit a rib, punctured a lung, passed through his diaphragm, and came to rest in his liver. The surgery at George Washington to remove the bullet lasted a little more than an hour. As Ronald Reagan speaks to Congress, Tim McCarthy has no regrets about what transpired. The devout Catholic father of two young children is a product of his rigorous training and is already making plans to get back on the job. In this way, McCarthy and Ronald Reagan are two very similar Irishmen. Ronald Reagan continues his speech. Sick societies don't produce dedicated police officers like Tom Delahanty. Officer Delahanty is also of Irish descent. He is considered an exemplary officer by his superiors, having received more than 30 commendations during his 17 years on the force. But the Washington Metropolitan cop earned instant retirement when John Hinckley's second bullet struck him in the neck. His injuries make it impossible for him to stay on the job. Delahanty wasn't supposed to be at the Hilton on March 30th. When the 45-year-old Pittsburgh native reported for work that fateful morning, he assumed that he would be doing his usual job with a canine division in Washington's 3rd District. But Delahanty's dog was suffering from heartworms. Kirk, as the mixed-breed canine is known, lives with Delahanty and his wife Jane in suburban Maryland. Delahanty chose to leave him home for the day and then accepted an assignment from the department's Special Services Division specifically to work the Hilton detail. Secret Service protocol stipulates that an agent never turn his back on a crowd when a president is present. But Tom Delahanty and the other Metro Police working the Hilton never received that training. This may have saved his life. The bullet that went into his neck as he turned to gawk at President Reagan would have hit him in the throat had he been facing the shooter. That is small solace for Delahanty. The bullet lodged in the lower left neck, dangerously close to his spinal column. Doctors at Washington Hospital Center initially decided against removing it, and only upon learning that the unexploded Devastator might detonate at any minute did the surgeons reverse that decision. As a safety precaution, they performed the operation wearing bulletproof vests. However, by the time Delahanty was released from the hospital on April 10th, the Devastator had left its mark. Irreversible nerve damage to his left arm means he must retire from the force. The department is also retiring Kirk, who will live out his days with Tom and Jean Delahanty. Even in retirement, though, the incident haunts Officer Delahanty. He clearly proved himself to be far better in the protection of President Reagan than John F. Parker, the Washington Metro policeman who went drinking before President Abraham Lincoln was shot in Ford's Theater in 1865. Yet the Secret Service is now saying that Hinckley could have been stopped. All it would have taken was for Delahanty and the other Metro police officers on the rope line to continue facing the crowd as Ronald Reagan departed the Hilton. It is a question that will dog Thomas Delahanty the rest of his life. Ronald Reagan pauses for emphasis. His eye contact with Congress is intense. He is firmly in control of the speech. Sick societies don't produce able and devoted public servants like Jim Brady. As Ronald Reagan speaks his name, Press Secretary James Brady lies in a bed at George Washington University Hospital, his head resting at a 20-degree angle to ease the pressure on his damaged brain. Brady was pronounced dead by the media after John Hinckley shot him in the left side of the forehead, but those early reports were erroneous. Even as President Reagan speaks, Jim Brady is beginning a recovery process that will last a lifetime. The bullet that struck him was the only devastator to explode on impact, sending shards of metal into his brain. The bear, as Brady calls himself, was comatose when the Secret Service brought him into George Washington University Hospital. Parts of his skull were missing, and his brain was visible. His eyes were swollen shut, and his breathing was rapid and shallow. Nerves were severed by the passage of the bullet, and a blood clot was forming on his brain. The trauma team cut off Brady's blue business suit and stashed it in a plastic bag beneath the gurney. A catheter was installed, as were intravenous lines to replenish fluid and blood. But it appeared to be all for naught. James Brady's brain was swelling dramatically, squeezing the brainstem out through the bottom of the skull. But Brady was in luck. He is right-handed, and while the bullet destroyed those portions of the brain that govern left-handed function, it spared those areas specific to right-handed behavior. He was also shot at a time of day when the hospital was at full staff, including a brain surgeon, allowing him to receive immediate assistance. Within 10 minutes, the trauma team stabilized Brady's condition. But at 5:13 p.m., as word of Brady's grave condition leaked, Dan Rather of CBS News told America, "It is now confirmed that Jim Brady has died." This was news to Sarah Brady, who was sitting with a social worker outside the emergency room. It was also news to Dr. Arthur Cobrine, who was leading the surgical team, then removing pieces of Brady's skull to relieve pressure on the brain. Remarkably, the operation was a success. And though James Brady was still suffering in the hospital, he was alive. Amazingly, he will eventually recover a great portion of his brain function. James Brady, the fourth Irish-American shot by Hinckley, is also now forcibly retired. For the rest of the Reagan administration, the person taking his place will always be known as Acting Press Secretary, out of respect for Brady. Ronald Reagan is almost finished. Six societies don't make people like us so proud to be Americans, and so very proud of our fellow citizens. With those words, Reagan publicly puts the assassination behind him. Now let's talk about getting spending and inflation under control and cutting your tax rates. 3 months later, standing in the Rose Garden at 10:55 on a sultry Washington summer morning, Ronald Reagan shows that he has rebounded from the shooting and is not a man to be taken lightly. "This morning at 7 a.m., the president tells reporters, "the union representing those who man America's air traffic control facilities called a strike. This was the culmination of 7 months of negotiations between the Federal Aviation Administration and the union. At one point in these negotiations, agreement was reached and signed by both sides, granting a $40 million increase in salaries and benefits. This is twice what other government employees can expect. It was granted in recognition of the difficulties inherent in the work these people perform. Now, however, the union demands are 17 times what had been agreed to, $681 million. This would impose a tax burden on their fellow citizens, which is unacceptable." In Moscow, the Soviet leadership is watching this speech very carefully, even though it is a domestic matter. They are still unconvinced of Ronald Reagan's toughness. They do not know what sort of man he truly is. He may have survived an assassination attempt, but until now, his leadership has not been tested by political crisis. Shortly after Reagan won the election, the leadership of the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization demanded a 100% pay increase. These federal employees are not just responsible for the safety of America's skies, but are also vital to national security thanks to the military jets that rely on their guidance. PATCO was the rare union, along with the Teamsters, that supported Reagan during the election, and he sympathizes with their pay request. But it is too much. Such an enormous raise at a time when he is committed to cutting taxes is impossible. So Reagan delivers an ultimatum. If they do not report for work within 48 hours, they have forfeited their jobs and will be terminated. A total of 13,000 air traffic controllers are now on strike. Their goal is to bring America to its knees, forcing Reagan to surrender. The threat of a major air disaster looms, an event that could destroy public faith in the president. This is what the Soviets are watching so closely. If Reagan backs down, they will know how to negotiate with him in the future. Understanding he is being personally challenged, Reagan is furious at the Union. It has crossed the line. He may appear affable and easygoing, but he has a long history of holding tight to his convictions. In his mind, there can be no backing down. As he tells Secretary of Transportation Drew Lewis, quoting the words of his presidential idol Calvin Coolidge, "There is no right to strike against the public safety by anybody, anywhere, at any time." In defiance of Reagan, more than 11,000 air traffic controllers ignore his warning and continue to walk the picket lines. 44 hours later, Reagan makes good on his promise. They are fired. All of them. "I'm sorry," Reagan tells the press. "I'm sorry for them. I certainly take no joy out of this." Later, Reagan will reflect on this day with a sense of justification. "I think it convinced people who thought otherwise that I meant what I said, especially the Soviets." George Shultz, who will one day serve as Reagan's Secretary of State, will call this the most important foreign policy decision Reagan has ever made. The brutal firings send a signal worldwide. Ronald Reagan is back, and he is just getting started. 21. House of Commons, London, England, April 3, 1982, 11:19 a.m. Margaret Thatcher is terrified. Heart racing, but appearing calm on the outside, the British Prime Minister rises to speak. She is dressed immaculately in a dark blue suit, accompanied by her trademark pearl necklace and earrings. Thatcher's reddish-brown hair, held in place by copious amounts of hairspray, rises several inches off her forehead and rings her face like a lion's mane. French President François Mitterrand likes to say that Thatcher has the eyes of Caligula and the mouth of Marilyn Monroe, in reference to her cunning and her offbeat look. Those traits are very much in evidence today. Mrs. Thatcher leans forward, her weak chin and blue eyes on full display. For the first time in 15 years, Parliament is meeting on Saturday. Both sides of the chamber are filled, and elected members sitting comfortably on benches padded in green leather. They have come to debate whether Britain will go to war. But there is another issue at stake today, one that few in this room will say out loud. Margaret Thatcher's political career could be all but over. "We are here," Thatcher begins, "because for the first time in many years, British sovereign territory has been invaded by a foreign power. And it is all her fault." Just yesterday, the Falklands, a collection of mountainous, windswept islands in the South Atlantic that Britain has controlled for nearly 150 years, were invaded by hundreds of Argentine commandos, infantry, and armored vehicles. The Argentines call the islands the Malvinas and have laid claim to them since the 19th century, protesting British occupation multiple times since. Margaret Thatcher knew the Argentine military government had been rattling its sabers over the Falklands to deflect the public's attention from the country's wretched economy. But she did not take the threat seriously, believing the islands insignificant and of no military value. "I thought that they would be so absurd and ridiculous to invade the Falklands that I did not think it would happen," she would later tell a board of inquiry, adding that when she realized the invasion was imminent, "it was the worst, I think, moment of my life." 8,000 miles away from London, the British Union Jack no longer snaps in the South Atlantic wind. It has now been replaced by the blue-and-white Argentine tri-band. In response, patriotic outrage seethes on the streets of Britain, almost all of it directed at Thatcher. In desperation, the Iron Lady has reached out to Ronald Reagan, asking the United States to help Britain retake the Falklands. But her fellow world leader and ideological soulmate is refusing. In fact, Reagan even suggests that Great Britain relinquish its claims to the Falklands, seeing the islands as a vestige of Britain's colonial past. But Reagan is being short-sighted. This is about more than the Falkland Islands. This is about salvaging national pride at a time when Britain's global status is sinking and when its special relationship with the United States is overwhelmingly lopsided in America's favor. To allow a nation such as Argentina and its arrogant military ruler, General Leopoldo Galtieri, to dictate terms is unthinkable to the British population. No. This is a time for war, even if Margaret Thatcher and Great Britain must go it alone. Thatcher has been Prime Minister for almost 3 years, and her conservative policies are fast losing popularity. The daughter of a grocer seems to have forgotten her humble beginnings. Her greatest success has been in cutting taxes for the rich while trimming services for the poor. Up until now, she has shown little interest in foreign affairs and has been a lackluster leader on both the domestic and international stages. Her nation's mood matches her dour performance. With unemployment hovering in double digits, the people of Britain are defeatist and cynical, a far cry from the plucky can-do spirit that buoyed Great Britain in World War II. Opinion polls show that if an election were held today, Margaret Thatcher would lose to her liberal opponents in a rout. Yet Thatcher has no intention of altering her policies. "This lady's not for turning," she has publicly announced. "People are prepared to put up with sacrifices if they know those sacrifices are the foundation of future prosperity." British Press Secretary Bernard Ingham would later describe Thatcher as "macho in a man's world, determined to work men under the table, fierce in argument, asking no quarter and giving none, in the back row when tact was handed out, impetuous, secretive, inspirational, and utterly dedicated, with a constitution as tough as old boots." Now that constitution will be sorely tested. On the surface, Margaret Thatcher appears ill-suited to lead Great Britain into battle. But lead she must. With little political opposition, the Iron Lady launches a most audacious scheme to get the Falklands back. She orders the head of the Navy, Admiral of the Fleet Sir Henry Leach, to prepare an attack. Within a day, an armada of British warships will set sail for the Falklands. 4 days after Margaret Thatcher's combat force sets sail from southern England, Ronald Reagan tiptoes into the Caribbean Sea. American warships are anchored offshore. The aquamarine ocean in Barbados is churning, with waves crashing onto the beach. Reagan begins to swim, though cautiously, knowing that he is not at full strength. It has almost been a year to the day since his release from the hospital after the assassination attempt. Part of Reagan's fitness regime now includes weightlifting and stretching, and as he emerges from the surf after the brief swim, he is proud of the 5 pounds of muscle he has added to his upper body. There are indications, however, that Ronald Reagan's health is not what it used to be. Reporters noted earlier in the week that he was completely exhausted by just 2 days of meetings with Caribbean leaders. And while Reagan made a point of venturing into the water for his swim, aware that photographers down the beach were capturing the moment, his vigorous session of backstroke and freestyle alongside his Secret Service bodyguard was brief. Ronald Reagan walks up the white sand to where Nancy sits with their hostess, former Hollywood actress Claudette Colbert. Nancy wears a strapless green and black bathing suit with a straw hat, while Colbert is clad in a white beach outfit. The actress did her own swim this morning, preferring 30 minutes of backstroke in the pool at the estate she has named Belle Reve. National Review editor William F. Buckley, Jr. and his wife Pat have joined Colbert and the Reagans for lunch. Despite the state of world affairs, the president considers this a day off. He and Nancy flew to Barbados on official business, but the weekend is to be a time of sun and relaxation. Their get-together with Colbert and the Buckleys will stretch from just past noon until almost midnight. First a cocktail hour, and then a dinner of curried chicken in Colbert's turquoise-colored dining room. Later, the Reagans will return to a private residence 6 miles away to sleep. Yet world matters do not simply vanish because Reagan is in the mood to relax. Those warships anchored within view of Colbert's two-story villa are American Navy communications ships, along with a hospital vessel standing by to treat Reagan should something once again go horribly wrong. Secretary of State Alexander Haig is currently in London, meeting with Margaret Thatcher about the Falklands, and Reagan is waiting on a report. While pretending to be neutral, the president is a firm backer of the British and has little sympathy for the Argentine dictator Galtieri, whom he considers a drunk. However, Reagan does believe the Argentine leader to be an ally in the war against communism. Evidence of this can be found in Argentina's military and financial support for a group known as the Contras, who are currently fighting the Marxist regime in Nicaragua. Since 1979, the United States has also backed the Contras. It is a policy that will soon lead to the greatest scandal of Reagan's presidency. But there is another reason Reagan is adopting a tone of neutrality in the Falklands situation. The Soviet Union is courting Galtieri by threatening to join Argentina in the conflict against the British. Reagan does not want this to happen, so he is cautious in his public statements. Secretary of State Haig's report from London is flashed to the White House Situation Room shortly after the Reagans finish lunch in Barbados. The Prime Minister has the bit in her teeth, owing to the politics of a unified nation and an angry parliament, Haig reports. She is clearly prepared to use force. Reagan spends part of the afternoon thinking of his response. He finally writes back to Haig just before dusk. The larger problem facing the president is not the Falklands crisis, but that he is still in the process of formulating his own foreign policy. In his 1 year in office, there have been stirrings of unrest in Poland, delicate communiques with the Soviet leadership, and an escalating crisis between Israel and Lebanon that now threatens to blossom into full-scale war. The report of your discussions in London makes clear how difficult it will be to foster a compromise that gives Maggie enough to carry on, and at the same time meets the test of equity with our Latin neighbors, Reagan responds to Haig. There isn't much room for maneuver in the British position. Then, knowing his words mean war, Ronald Reagan gets dressed for happy hour. On April 25th, less than 3 weeks after sailing from England, British Special Forces and Royal Marines retake South Georgia Island. The weather is terrible, a combination of Force 10 gales and driving snow. Two British helicopters crash while attempting to rescue a group of commandos stranded on a glacier in the severe weather, and initial reports back to London indicate the loss of 17 British soldiers. Thatcher weeps at the news, only to be told hours later that all the men survived. South Georgia Island is taken without a single casualty. "Rejoice," she urges the citizens of Great Britain as the news breaks. "Just rejoice." But the Argentines are resolute. They still hold the island's main city, Stanley, even as a full-scale British invasion looms. Argentine President Galtieri's nation, like Great Britain, is engulfed in patriotic fervor. Galtieri, the silver-haired former combat engineer, refuses to back down. He's been in office just 4 months, and this test of his administration will be either his greatest triumph or his political undoing. On April 30th, the British declare a total exclusion zone around the Falklands. Any vessel found within a 200 nautical mile radius around the islands will be considered a ship of war and will be subject to immediate attack. 3 days later, with Margaret Thatcher's complete approval, the Argentine cruiser General Belgrano is sunk by a British torpedo. Its two escort vessels refuse to stay and rescue the survivors, cowardly fleeing back to the mainland. 323 sailors are sent to their graves in the icy South Atlantic waters. 2 days after the Belgrano is sunk, Argentina gets its revenge. The HMS Sheffield is part of a British task force patrolling 70 miles off the Falklands. Shiny Chef, as it is known for its highly polished stainless steel fittings, is a state-of-the-art Type 42 destroyer. At 7:50 a.m. on May 4th, an Argentine patrol aircraft picks up the Sheffield on its radar. 2 hours later, a pair of Super Étendard Argentine fighter jets take off from an Air Force base at the tip of South America. With French-made Exocet anti-ship missiles affixed to the bottom of their fuselages, the jets hone in on the unsuspecting Sheffield. Argentine pilots Lieutenant Armando Mayora and Lieutenant Commander Augusto Bedacaraz use caution when approaching the ship, flying just a few feet above the ocean to avoid being detected. Despite their stealth, radar operators on board the aircraft carrier HMS Invincible pick up the Étendards when the planes are 180 miles away. But the British fleet has undergone a number of false alarms in the past few days, thinking they see planes where none exist. The officer in charge of Invincible's electronics ignores the sighting, telling his radar operators that they are chasing rabbits. No warning is sent to Sheffield or any other British vessel in the vicinity. On board the Sheffield, the mood is calm. The crew is not at battle stations, and the ship's officers are chatting with their superiors in London via satellite phone. The electromagnetic effects of the phone interfere with the ship's Type 965 radar, making it all but useless. So it is that both Argentine planes fly within 12 miles of the Sheffield before launching their exocets. Pilots Mayora and Bedacaraz fire their missiles and then split up to avoid detection. The Exocet's rocket propellant ignites both missiles 1 second after launch. The missiles drop to just 6 feet above the Atlantic and race toward the unsuspecting ship at 700 miles per hour. The sea was very calm, British Sub-Lieutenant Steve Iacovu will later remember. We were looking out to sea, and I thought it looked like a torpedo was on its way because the sea was shimmering and shaking. With no time to undertake defensive measures, the crew takes cover. "Missile attack! Hit the deck!" is quickly broadcast throughout the ship. One exocet lands harmlessly in the sea. The other does not. The missile pierces the Sheffield's hull on the starboard side. Quickly, a 15-foot hole opens up and the seawater pours in. Luckily for the men of the Sheffield, the missile is a dud, and the 165-kilogram warhead does not explode. However, flames from the rocket propellant ignite everything in the Exocet's path. Diesel fuel stored in the forward auxiliary machine room detonates, sending thick clouds of acrid black smoke throughout the vessel. The heat is so intense that all efforts to fight the fire are in vain. The blaze rages unabated, asphyxiating and burning all those trapped below decks. Amazingly, the Sheffield remains afloat, and the crew struggles to guide her into port. The order to abandon ship is given 6 days later, and the empty ship is towed into port. The Sheffield becomes the first British vessel sunk in combat since World War II. 20 officers and ratings, enlisted men, died, the official report will read. Some personnel in the galley area were killed on impact. This is the message that is read aloud to the House of Commons at 10:56 p.m. on May 4th. Margaret Thatcher sits with her head bowed as British Defense Secretary John Knott tells the members of Parliament the sad news. The one thing she has feared more than any other was the loss of a ship. Now that has come to pass. The Prime Minister does not reveal her emotions until she returns to 10 Downing Street, whereupon she breaks down. Margaret Thatcher weeps. Going to war was easy, but knowing that her decisions cost young men their lives, and that mothers throughout Great Britain are now learning the news that they have lost a son, is devastating. Her own boy, 22-year-old Mark, and her husband Dennis comfort Thatcher in the sitting room at 10 Downing Street as she sobs. "What are you making all this fuss for?" Dennis asks bluntly as the Prime Minister's crying continues. He is not always fond of being a politician's spouse, having suffered a nervous breakdown and abandoned his wife for 2 months early in her career. Fond of a large drink and a laugh, Dennis was unsure of whether to divorce Margaret Thatcher or remain married to this workaholic woman with the buck teeth and frizzy hair who talks politics non-stop. In the end, he came back home, but Dennis Thatcher is not one to mince words. When there's a war on, you've got to expect things to not go right all the time. The next morning, the Iron Lady is stunned to get a message from Ronald Reagan, who once again suggests that the British consider leaving the Falklands to the Argentines. Reagan believes the conflict is not worth the price. Margaret Thatcher's mourning is replaced by rage. More than 200 British soldiers and sailors have died, and hundreds more have been wounded. In a scathing response, she makes one thing very clear. Great Britain is not backing down. The men of the Sheffield will not have died in vain. It is Memorial Day in Washington, D.C. Ronald Reagan started his day at Arlington National Cemetery in a moment of remembrance for the many Americans who lost their lives in war. Now he places a phone call to Margaret Thatcher. Margaret?
Yes, Ron?
Could you hear me all right?
We could hear you very well. Can you hear me?
Yes, seems a little echo, but I guess that goes with the line we're on. Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher are speaking via the transatlantic hotline linking the White House with 10 Downing Street. It is 6:03 in Washington, close to midnight in London. 4 more British ships have been sunk since the Sheffield went down, including her sister ship, the HMS Coventry. More than 200 British servicemen have lost their lives on land and sea, but British troops have successfully retaken many parts of the Falklands. The war will not be over, however, until the British capture the capital city of Stanley. Could I impose and be presumptuous and give you some thoughts right now on the Falkland situation? Asks President Reagan.
Yes, of course,
Thatcher replies with a curt tone. I want to congratulate you on what you and your young men are doing down there. You've taken major risks, and you've shown that unprovoked aggression does not pay. Thatcher thanks the president, and then listens in stony silence as Reagan puts forth a plan for a ceasefire to avoid complete Argentinian humiliation. He hopes for a withdrawal of British troops and for peace to be maintained by a United Nations peacekeeping force. Thatcher is having none of it.
Just supposing Alaska was invaded, she asks furiously.
I have to say that I don't think Alaska is a similar situation.
More or less so,
Thatcher replies, not backing down an inch. It was always my understanding or feeling that you had in the past been prepared to offer independence to the islands. With that, Reagan completes the last full sentence he will utter in this conversation. Despite the tone of civility and the awareness that Great Britain is the weaker partner in their special relationship, Margaret Thatcher is uncowed by Ronald Reagan. Even as she speaks, British wounded are beginning the long journey back to Britain. Some maimed, some severely burned, they will bear the marks of the Falklands War the rest of their lives. Margaret Thatcher feels the emotional burden of their sacrifice and that of those who have fallen. She has slept little since the war began. The Prime Minister's official study is a short 17-step walk up a staircase from her private apartment. She ascends those steps each night to listen to the BBC World News with her personal assistant, Cynthia Crawford. For the workaholic Thatcher, this is the closest she comes to an actual friendship. Crawford will remember, "We used to sit on the bedroom floor. The heating would have gone off, and there was a 2-bar electric fire in the bedroom. Kick off our shoes and relax." She had practically no sleep for 3 months, just catnapping. She was so incredibly strong and determined. Not once did she flag. After so many of these anxious nights, Margaret Thatcher has absolutely no intention of buckling under the suggestions of Ronald Reagan or any international peacekeeping body. She is not a woman fond of small talk, and her sense of humor is so dry that most people miss it. In a word, Margaret Thatcher is a serious woman. So she lets the U.S. president know what's on her mind.
"Ron, I'm not handing over the island," Thatcher tells him. "I can't lose the lives and blood of our soldiers to hand over the islands to a contact. It's not possible." She continues, You are surely not asking me, Ron, after we've lost some of our finest young men, you are surely not saying that after the Argentine withdrawal that our forces and our administration become immediately idle? I had to go to immense distances and mobilize half my country. I just had to go. Yes, Reagan says before Thatcher can cut him off. She then launches into a long rant about Britain's territorial rights. Theirs is a friendship strong enough to endure this disagreement, so she plunges forward with abandon. Margaret, Reagan says, trying to get in a word during her tirade. Well, he tries again. Yes. Yes, well, the point is this, Ron, Thatcher concludes. She has never been one to bully, unlike many politicians. However, she is relentless in making her point. We have borne the brunt of this alone. We have some of our best ships lost because for 7 weeks the Argentines refused to negotiate reasonable terms. Well, Margaret, I'm sorry I intruded, Reagan says before hanging up. You haven't intruded at all, and I'm glad you telephoned. Margaret Thatcher hangs up the hotline. 2 weeks later, Stanley falls and Argentina surrenders. She required guts to do it, her single greatest quality, and she deserved some cross-party support, liberal British leader David Owen will comment of the war. Thatcher's personal resolve made all the difference between victory or defeat. Owen continued, Thatcher would not have remained prime minister if General Galtieri's forces had not been thrown off the Falklands. In the process, the British prime minister has emerged as a global force. Her nation, as she has suggested, rejoices. 22. White House Oval Office, Washington, D.C., April 15, 1983, 9:57 a.m. Ronald Reagan is struggling. As he presides over a mid-morning meeting of his speechwriters, the president strains to hear the words they are saying. Age is taking its toll. Weakened physically since the assassination attempt, he continues to go deaf in his right ear. His left ear is only marginally better. Reagan tries to keep this a secret, but everyone in the room is well aware that the president's hearing is impaired. Seated in a cream-colored chair with his back to the fireplace, Reagan crosses his legs and pretends to listen as his six-person team sits on two couches in the center of the room. They are there to discuss the president's upcoming speaking engagements, but the Oval Office's poor acoustics are making it difficult for Reagan to decipher what is being said. To make matters even worse, the three men and three women often talk over one another. Looking on silently, Reagan tries to follow the conversation by reading lips and watching body language to see if a direct question is aimed his way. The meeting is brisk and efficient, just 15 minutes long. But during longer policy sessions with his senior advisers, Reagan has been known to grow so bored that he gives up all attempts to follow the proceedings, spending his time doodling on a yellow legal pad. This may not be normal behavior for most presidents, but the 72-year-old Reagan knows he must husband his energy carefully in order to make it through the busy days. Today, for example, began with breakfast. He dined with Nancy in the second-floor residence, eating his usual bran cereal, toast, and decaffeinated coffee. He said goodbye to Nancy with his usual gusto, pulling her to him as if they would be separated for months instead of mere hours. The president then took an elevator down to the first floor, where he was met by Secret Service agents. He then walked to the armored door of the Oval Office via the West Wing colonnade, where he began his workday. After a series of morning meetings, Ronald Reagan will have a formal lunch with West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl to discuss the growing Soviet threat. By 2:30 in the afternoon, his work will be done. This being a Friday, the Reagans will fly to Camp David for the weekend. But the time of their departure is always subject to change. As with all the president's travel arrangements, an astrologer living in San Francisco must first approve. Nancy Reagan keeps the Vassar-educated socialite Joan Quigley, 56 years old, on a $3,000 per month retainer secretly to provide astrological guidance. Nancy remains deeply superstitious, making sure to sleep with her head facing north, and constantly knocks on wood. But her dependence on Quigley runs much deeper. Very few members of the White House staff know that Nancy's astrologer controls much of the president's calendar. To make sure that White House operators do not eavesdrop on their conversations, Nancy has a private phone line in the White House and another at Camp David connecting her directly to the stargazer. Without her approval, Deputy Chief of Staff Michael Deaver will one day write of Quigley, Air Force One does not take off. But there is one item on today's agenda so minor that Quigley has not been consulted, and Ronald Reagan's personal assistant, Kathy Osborne, has not typed it into the schedule. Sometime during the day, Reagan will take a moment to affix his signature to a proclamation naming April 10th through 16th as National Mental Health Week. The purpose is to seek and encourage better understanding of mental disorders and to bring welcome hope to the mentally ill. 8 miles away in southeast Washington, D.C., John Hinckley is finding that it pays to be mentally ill. Rather than suffer a heinous punishment for his attempted assassination of the president and near murder of 3 other men, Hinckley has been found not guilty of all crimes by reason of insanity. Thus, he spends his days in St. Elizabeth's Hospital, a century-old brick psychiatric facility. There, Hinckley has a soft life. He resides in a fourth-floor room, eats in the cafeteria, attends therapy sessions, shoots pool, plays his guitar, and watches TV. He can listen to any music he likes, and his hair remains long and shaggy. There are no shackles on his wrists or ankles. The only significant difference between this new life and his previous one is that Hinckley can no longer travel impulsively. His monetary woes are a thing of the past. Shockingly, Hinckley still pines for Jodie Foster, telling the New York Times in a bizarre letter, "My actions of March 30, 1981 have given special meaning to my life, and no amount of imprisonment or hospitalization can tarnish my historical deed. The shooting outside the Washington Hilton Hotel was the greatest love offering in the history of the world. I sacrificed myself and committed the ultimate crime in hopes of winning the heart of a girl. It was an unprecedented demonstration of love. But does the American public appreciate what I've done? Does Jodie Foster appreciate what I've done?" Hinckley continues, "I am Napoleon and she is Josephine. I am Romeo and she is Juliet. I am John Hinckley Jr. and she is Jodie Foster. The world can't touch us." Ironically, one of the first things Ronald Reagan did when he came into office was slash federal funding for the treatment of mental illness, trimming the budget for the National Institute of Mental Health, and repealing the Mental Health Systems Act of 1980. Yet, as the definition of mental impairment grows over time to include not just the insane or psychotic, like John Hinckley, but also those whose faculties are diminished by age, there are signs that the president himself may be sliding into this spectrum. The New York Times reported as early as 1980 that his penchant for contradictory statements, forgetting names, and general absent-mindedness were considered by some to be a sign of Alzheimer's disease. This very specific form of dementia displays itself as confusion, impaired thought, and impaired speech. In truth, Ronald Reagan can be sharp at times. Often he spins entertaining yarns, adding dialects and jokes to his presentations. But on other occasions, the president gets lost mid-story. Sometimes he will tell a tale about some event in his life when in fact he is confusing it with a movie role he once played. His staff is fond of saying that Reagan has his good days and his bad days, and they know that the president tends to think more slowly in the evening than in the afternoon. In addition, Reagan has developed an essential tremor, a slight shaking of the hands and nodding of the head. Though not a sign of brain impairment, it will grow worse with age. Ronald Reagan has admitted to journalists that his mother died of senility, and said that should such a condition ever affect him, he will resign the office of the President of the United States. But today, as his speechwriters rise promptly from their seats at 10:10 and file out of the Oval Office, nobody is realistically suggesting that Ronald Reagan is senile, or that he should resign. Not yet.